from the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, produced in Nelson, British Columbia, at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman, and on today's episode, we'll explore a number of topics over the next hour, including a fascinating look into the culinary and edible world of seaweed along the British Columbia coast. In mid-February, Deconstructing Dinner visited southern Vancouver Island, and in particular, the community of Souk, which is home to an active and well-connected food community. One of those foodies is Diane Bernard, who is more commonly known as the Seaweed Lady. Diane is the founder of Outer Coast Seaweeds, a producer of seaweed-based skincare products, but Diane is also active in using and supplying seaweeds for culinary use, and we'll learn more about that today. And in the second half of the show, the part 5 of our ongoing Deconstructing Dinner in Our Schools series, where we'll visit with two more conscientious cooks, also in Souk, who lend their skills to a unique culinary arts program offered at Edward Milne Community School, the area's local high school. While the culinary program itself is unique among Canadian high schools, also exciting is the program's very own vegetable and herb garden and fruit trees that the students are also engaged with throughout their classes. And through the work of Asif Rashid, a journalist from CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, we'll also learn of a demonstration staged at Dalhousie University by a group known as Campus Action on Food. In December 2009, the group held an event to raise awareness of the exclusive food service contracts at the school's Student Union Building, which, similar to many institutions, restrict students to purchasing from only one or two food service companies. As promised on a recent episode, there are a few updates to some topics we've covered over the past year that are worth sharing before we hit the west coast of Canada and taste some seaweeds. And the first is some good news from anyone who has been concerned over the possible elimination of the University of Guelph's organic agriculture major. Back in April 2009, we aired a feature on the precarious position that that program had entered into when, shortly before in March, the university had announced it would cut the organic major, among other programs, due to low enrollment and budgetary challenges. The decision sparked a notable amount of protest among students, faculty, and the general public, who questioned the motives behind eliminating the only organic agriculture major of its kind in Canada, despite the organic food sector being the fastest growing within the food system. After a close vote by the university's Senate, a decision was made to allow the program to continue for an extra 12 months in order to redesign itself and seek more financial support. With almost 12 months having now passed, on January 29th of this year, the Ontario Agriculture College, located at the university, announced that it had withdrew its initial proposal to axe the organic agriculture major and that the college-level committee supported that decision. That decision was then handed to the higher-level university bodies, and on February 22nd, the university's Senate voted to not axe the program after all, thereby permitting the organic major to continue and to exist at the University of Guelph. If you missed our episode that first began exploring this controversial decision, you can find it archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the April 9th, 2009 broadcast. In other agricultural education news, Fleming College in Lindsay, Ontario, has chosen to postpone the launch of their one-year sustainable agriculture program that was set to commence in January. We featured that program here on the show back in October. The college has decided to instead launch the program in January 2011. And some more exciting news out of Vancouver, where Martin Gunst had launched his pedal-powered FarmFresh grocery delivery business in 2009. We heard from Martin here on the show as part of our October 1st broadcast, and that show directed some very positive attention towards Martin's grocer Gunst business. Not long after that episode aired, we received an email from Martin that read as follows. I've got to say that having me on the show has done great things for Grocer Gunst. The publicity from such a well-respected show has brought unprecedented levels of interest. My plans for the business for next year now involve expanding to cover most of the city of Vancouver through a partnership with the organization known as BEST, which stands for Better Environmentally Sound Transportation, who will subsidize and provide some capital for hiring other cyclists to work with me. So that's some great news from Martin, and it's always great to hear how the show can help raise awareness of and support innovative startups like Martin's business. And you can be sure that Deconstructing Dinner will continue to follow how Martin's business grows to serve more Vancouver residents with pedal-powered groceries. In February 2010, Deconstructing Dinner made its way out of the interior of British Columbia and onto southern Vancouver Island. On February 14th, Deconstructing Dinner spoke to a sold-out audience in the community of North Saanich, where many notable foodies were in attendance, including the leader of the Green Party of Canada, Elizabeth May. From there, I headed to the BC capital of Victoria, and then along the southwestern tip of the island to the community of Souk. Over the course of today's and upcoming episodes, we'll listen to a number of interviews recorded there with people like Sinclair Phillip, the co-owner of the well-known hotel restaurant, the Souk Harbor House, and who also has extensive experience with Slow Food Canada. We'll hear from Bob Liptrod of Tugwell Farm, a honey and mead producer, mead being honey wine, and many other interesting residents in the area who are somehow involved in what is a very active local food community. But today we'll meet Diane Bernard, who over the past 12 years has been quite literally immersed in seaweed. Her passion for seaweeds has landed her with the title of Seaweed Lady. And as you'll soon come to appreciate, the title is no doubt fitting. Diane operates Outer Coast Seaweeds, and most particularly the Seaflora brand of seaweed-based skincare products. But beyond that focus of her business, Diane is also an avid culinary user of seaweeds and also supplies chefs throughout the province with freshly harvested varieties. Diane has a commercial license to harvest seaweeds along the southwestern coast of Vancouver Island between the communities of Souk and Port Renfrew. I spent time with Diane both indoors and out, learning about the exciting and relatively unexplored world of seaweed. Diane spoke about the history of collecting and using seaweeds along the British Columbia coast.
This is pterodophora, and it grows fabulously big under the big giant kelps. And here it's, you know, the end of the winter, we're about to embrace some spring, so these kinds of seaweeds are just tossed up into the corners here and they sit. First Nations used seaweeds, but not in the way that we tend to think, more for medicinal purposes and useful purposes. For example, the big bull kelp, they would use that cord, dry it, tie it together, use it in forms of rope. They would use it for medicinal purposes, burns, you know, that kind of thing, because seaweeds have a very slick, gelatinous material to them that's quite healthy and soothing, so they were using that. First Nations of British Columbia had fantastic food sources here. I mean, just look at, you know the salmon and the whales and their lifestyle on the ocean as well as in the forest. So seaweeds were not really a food source for them. They did dry them. They still do dry them. They use them, historically they would use them for layering their boxes, their bent wood boxes with seaweeds, and then putting your salmon in that, so there was a smoking kind of and a flavor of it. Up the coast now in Ocean Falls, I believe, still, up in the Queen Charlotte's, the Haida Gwaii, they will dry them. They're drying porphyra, on the coast, on the mainland coast, up around Prince Rupert and that, they dry them on their roofs, and they still do. They still do that. And they'll use them in soups and stews. The women will harvest and dry that way.
Diane Bernard of Outer Coast Seaweeds speaking to me at the Souk Harbor House, a well-known inn and restaurant that we'll learn more about on an upcoming episode of the show. The Souk Harbor House is, as some might say, the epicenter of the area's food culture. And no matter who I met in the area involved in the local food system, they maintained at least some connection to the inn's restaurant, which in most cases was because their products were featured on the restaurant's local-centric menu. The Souk Harbor House has long used seaweeds in their restaurant's kitchen, and Diane has played a role in helping supply their chefs.
Souk Harbor House is the lead here on anything adventuresome, you know, I think in the Pacific Northwest, if not like in North America. They have been very supportive of local wild women, but local wild businesses as well. And so they have been working with seaweeds, as long as I've known them, which is since the day they opened their doors. The chefs here are very comfortable with seaweeds. They had a chef, Edward Tucson. They now have Sam Benedetto. And they have done amazing things with my seaweeds. And so I harvest for them. We have done great, great meals. We have done meals up and down the coast. I worked with the chefs in Kingfisher, Tojo in Japan, in Vancouver, and Sea Restaurant, Rob Clark, Michael Statlander in Ontario. So, I have a very nice group of chefs that I work with.
As can be expected from any wild food, the nutritional composition of seaweeds makes them quite attractive. And Diane explains.
It's true. Seaweeds are some of the healthiest plants on the planet. They have huge amounts of vitamins A, E, C. They have significant amounts of vitamins D, which we know is, Canadians, the further north you go, the more vitamin D you need. They have all the Bs, which including vitamin B12, which for vegans and vegetarians is very nice, significant sources of it. They have vitamin K, 60 trace mineral elements. They have excellent properties for anti-inflammatory, antiviral. They are fabulously healthy. Mm. Healthy oceans, and you've got healthy seaweeds.
Now, while seaweeds are high in nutrients and minerals, they are, just like any seafood, also capable of absorbing toxins that might be polluting the waters in which they grow. Diane is well aware of such risks and describes how she mitigates that risk to ensure that her seaweeds are safe.
Seaweeds take in fabulous nutrients, and I always say, but they don't separate out the good from the bad. And if your seaweeds are exposed to pollutions, like in harbors and basins, runoff, nasty stuff, they will take in excess levels of mercury, lead, and arsenic. So you want to know the sources of your seaweed. My seaweeds are certified organic USDA, and all of them. And I have went through 5 years of testing around waters in this area. And one thing else about seaweeds as to what we're here for is to, they are the healthiest, but why are they the healthiest? And is it strictly because of our oceans? And yes, but structurally, and I'm hauling out some interesting seaweeds here for you, structurally, seaweeds are really, really different mm-hmm. from land plants. And I use the analogy, on my tours that seaweeds are like a garden, and they're wild, they're exotic, they grow, they fruit, they reproduce, and they slough off. Seaweeds, when they grow, they are fresh, they are colorful, they are bright, they are crispy, they taste fabulous, mm-hmm. And I'm just pulling out of the bucket here a few. But where they differ is that seaweeds don't have a root system, mm-hmm. and I'm holding up one here for you. And the light shining through it makes it kind of nice. Mm-hmm. Their texture is more like fabric than they are like plants. Mm-hmm. And this one's a nice, soft brown color, nice big ribbon. Mm-hmm. But look at this. This is a holdfast, and this holdfast does not anchor into a soil, right? It does not take nutrients out of the soil. So what they do is they cling. They cling to rocks, they generally, most of the time, and they cling to each other. Mm. They'll cling to logs, a little bit like this, and they sprout and grow. So, and that's what I was bringing here, on the pteridophora here. That is a holdfast. And you can see the shape. That was hanging onto a rock, and that's what it does. They don't take their nutrients from soil. Mm. So when I went to the USDA to say, hey, I've got I want certification. Their thing was, well, you have no soil to test, therefore you can't be organic. And I was like, okay, let's just back up here. So we did years of testing on our water, and we went back and argued, and they went, okay, you're in.
Diane added that she also gets both her seaweeds and the surrounding waters tested annually by independent bodies. If you are just tuning in, this is Deconstructing Dinner, where we're listening to my visit with Diane Bernard of Outer Coast Seaweeds, based in the community of Souk on British Columbia's Vancouver Island. I sat down with Diane at the Souk Harbor House, one of the many restaurants that she has supplied with seaweeds for culinary use. As I waited for her in the lobby, she had walked in with a bucket of freshly harvested seaweeds, from which she, one by one, began pulling them out and laying them on the floor.
So all these ones you're pulling out here, are these all edible?
Yes, they are. And they're fun. They're funky. They tend to have, bizarre kind of shapes to them. They are evolutionary-wise super ancient. They predate anything growing on the land, on the terrestrial part of the planet. And they are, I figure, about 800 million years old. They, in the Ordovician period, I'm sort of trying to track it down. And I'm fascinated by their growth. They look like plants, but they don't act like land plants. So that's part of my fascination with them. And when the sharks were here, and we know that they're estimated in the 400 million mark, these guys are already here. Seaweeds were already well established, on their way and set. So back to that thing about not having a root system, that means their cell structure is different because they don't transport nutrients up from a soil. They don't break nutrients down from the sun and from the soil to make this fronds.
It's all from the water.
It's all from the water. So they, and they're not linked to, here in the Pacific Northwest, they're not linked to the warmth of the water. We tend to expect it to, land plants grow as we get warmer, brighter. They are linked to directly to the tilt of the earth towards the sun. So December 21st here in Canada, here in Nelson, everybody's happy, celebratory about the longest night of the year is over, right? So in fact, seaweeds start to grow around that time. Mm. All seaweeds do. And in the northern hemisphere, reverse in the southern hemisphere, and they start to grow. And today, beautiful sunny day, but our ocean temperatures here don't change. It's damn cold all year round. And it's cold whether it's July 1st or January 1st. So never be impressed with a polar bear swim. And it's the on January 1st because the water temperature is just as cold in July. Mm. It's the air temperature. But the seaweeds grow relative to that tilt of the earth towards the sun.
And how quickly are some of these ones we have here growing? How long, for example, would this one here take to grow to where it's at now?
We're looking at some of the fastest growing plants on the planet. And we have a seaweed here, the Nereocystis. It's a fabulous, the big bull kelp. And the bull kelp starts off in December 21st, 22nd, as a millimeter in high. The spores have landed. That's how they reproduce. They've started to attach, and they've started to grow. I harvest Nereocystis, the bull kelp, in August, and it will be an impressive 30 to 35 meters in length. Mm. That's monster growth, and that's 10 months of growth. Mm. This is Alaria, beautiful seaweed. So when we harvest Alaria, and that's spelled A-L-A-R-I-A, we harvest up in this area so that it continues to grow and it protects the reproductive portions of the seaweed. Has a beautiful stipe down the center of it, you can see. So no stem, right? So it's got the stipe. These are the fronds, and this is what's edible. No, the whole thing is edible, actually. And the fronds will get quite a bit wider. And locally, the kids like to call this the lasagna seaweed because I take it and trim off the frond. And you can see, and it will be much wider. And there's a little bit of the gelatinous material. And I will lay it, treat it just like a piece of pasta, and layer tomatoes, mussels, clams, and Alaria in the pan and bake it. And it's fantastic.
So would you boil that first, or you would bake it just from...
Oh, I'm a real fan of raw food, so I keep it as light as possible. Mm. You may want to rinse it a little bit. I rinse mine in the ocean water, so, and because the oceans are clean here, and do it that way. This, I'm just going to try this, and actually you can take it, and you can roll it up, like this, and just slice it al dente, and it'll be like a pasta, right? Fabulous with wild salmon. Mm. So seaweeds are more vegetable-like in their taste than they are fish-like. People tend to think of them being as maybe semi-fishy or strong in their flavor. They're not. And again, if you pick up a seaweed and you try that and you get that kind of overpowering odor or overpowering taste to it, you've got a seaweed product that's been harvested in a compost pile on the shore. Never go there. You want to try a piece? Very crunchy. Yeah. It's my favorite piece of the seaweed. I can eat this all year round, never tired of it. Very light vegetable type, great in salads, great just to chew on, really good for children. You'll try that. Seaweed has fabulous fiber in it. And, you know, we're all moving in the same direction in terms of age, and fiber is good for you. And I believe that fiber, a lot of the minerals, the trace mineral elements of seaweed are locked up in the fiber. So I get really ticked when I see international companies around the world stripping the seaweed for their gelatinous properties, which seaweeds are known for, stripping out the fiber, all the vitamins and minerals. And the single largest use of seaweed in the industry in North America is to strip it, bleach it, get every ounce of every vitamin out of it, every mineral out of it, so that North Americans can have their chocolate milk without separating. So that, I find, is a crime. And, you know, France, Denmark, Scotland, they're all up there in that. I just came back from a conference in PEI in 2008, and I met some very good seaweed people from Ireland and the east coast of the U.S., and we would refer to them as the pudding boys, you know, because that's what they want to do with seaweed.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. We're listening to Diane Bernard of Sooke, British Columbia, sharing her widespread knowledge of everything seaweed. As she continued her show and tell, she introduced a few photos of some other seaweeds that she wasn't able to harvest the evening before we met, and then she introduced a well-known seaweed that she did come across, sea lettuce.
And there's a nice photo there of rockweed and fucus, and a little bit here of the bright green, which is sea lettuce. And I have some here, and unfortunately, like I said, the year, the timing, it's all, this one, this is blown apart, it's left over from last year. This is a wonderful seaweed to eat, and it looks just like lettuce, so it's called sea lettuce. And bright green, lovely tissue color. At this time of year, it acts, looks, tastes like wax paper, so it's not good to eat. And it's been blown apart, so it's usually it's a piece, you know, fairly big, and great for soups, stews, great for wrapping halibut, you know, and putting it around, steaming, good for salmon. Seaweeds dovetail beautifully with seafood and fish. You'll find sea lettuce pretty much here right through the Pacific Northwest in the lower tidal area, and easy to get at. For your own use, yes, you can do that. The harvesting it commercially, of course, you have to have licenses and all of that. And again, I keep cautioning people, just be aware of your upland uses and what are the uses in the waters around you. This is the infamous seaweed. This is kombu in Japan, highly prized in Japan. Chefs here on the Caucasian trained chefs, they look at this and sort of go, "Oh God, Diane, what are you? What have you got?" But if you want to feel that, it's like leather, and highly prized for its vitamins and minerals. And they'll dry it, and they'll use it and put it in their soups and their stews, and they dry it and keep it. This is a prized seaweed, ceremonial in Japan. The seaweed here, and you can see, watch, you see it's been in my bucket because I harvested this last night. There we go. That's the stuff that science now is having a great time with. It looks, it's a gel, and the closest thing I can use it is called a marine aloe vera type gel. High vitamins and B's, high in minerals, high in vitamins A, E, and C. And when the chefs get nervous when I haul this out, I just tell them to put it on their face because it will make them beautiful and to just chill out.
And do flavors differ noticeably between seaweeds, or do they tend to all carry a similar taste?
No, they do. They vary quite a bit. The Elaria. The chefs I've had out, they comment on it being like a rhubarb type smell to it and taste. They like the, and also at times a sort of a zucchini sweet pea kind of thing, a greeny kind of taste. The sea lettuce, of course, just a very nice fresh green flavor to it. The rockweed here, which I'm just going to show you, funky seaweed that hangs off the rocks. what it's highly prized for is the puffs on the end. And when you're talking to people here from the coast, the puffs, they all go, oh, yeah, yeah, you work with the puffs. And the puffs actually, too, have this gelatinous gel inside them. And the science behind it now is excellent for burn victims, excellent for scar tissue healing, excellent as antiviral and antibacterial properties. So, and I'm not talking about the beauty industry science, I'm talking about agriculture science, and I'm talking about the medical science. So the puffs can be harvested and cut and dried, and they make great chips. Really nice to chew on, and they have an earthy, they have an earthy flavor to them. And I think if Sinclair was here, he would be describing them like you would mushrooms. You know, sort of a rich, earthy kind of flavor to this one.
After the indoor seaweed show and tell, I followed Diane Bernard down to the shore of the Strait of Juan de Fuca, along which she harvests her seaweeds. We spoke of the beneficial uses of seaweeds for gardeners, and she spoke of the harvesting practices that she uses to ensure her actions are sustainable.
Seaweeds are fantastic. It's a compost fertilizer, extra bigger roots, stronger stems, and bigger and fleshier fruits. The science behind that has been around for, you know, 30 years. And my tours tend to start over there, and people will come down, like I said, and I use the analogy of a garden, and then we'll walk along here, and we head out about a good several hundred meters past those rocks there. And this area, I say, is about 700 different species of seaweed. We knock the socks off of France, and the Mediterranean, and across the way is the Olympics. So you get the Great Juan de Fuca Strait here. Mad, fast moving water, and that contributes to a lot of movement and keeps it very cold all year. And the so you've got a national park over there, the Olympic Park, so very little action going on here. We have our own coastal park system here on my side, so we don't have a lot of activity here in the straits in terms of active pollutants.
So on a day when we would see, you know, at low tide the seaweed that's out here, is there an approach that you would take to ensure that there is a more sustainable practice? Is there such concerns with seaweed?
Absolutely. We are we're pretty hard on our resources, whether we're here in North America, Canada and the US combined. And we have done devastating things to our seaweed resources, particularly down the California coastline. And in the 70s, you know, huge over-harvesting problems, inappropriate harvesting techniques. Here in Canada, here on the British Columbia coastline, we're required to harvest by hand. And that really keeps things in check. We don't have oil exploration on this coastline yet. And so that really, really helps us as well. And keeps the coastline, you know, pretty clean. We harvest so that we do not interfere with the growing of the seaweed. We never yank them off the rocks. We have to have sharp instruments to cut. And we harvest from boats as well as harvesting from the shore or going into the low tide from the shore. So we'll have boots and sharp instruments, a knife, scissors, and we cut. And so the chefs that I work with, and we do not devastate an area, like go out and just harvest one kind of seaweed. And that's where I treat it like a garden. And we do things like, well, this time of the year, this week, Alaria is growing fabulous. The chefs get Alaria. The nether time will be sea lettuce. That's what they're going to get. And we harvest a variety, so we're not doing any big damage to one seaweed and not interfering. So we don't want to get into monoculture, like what's happening on the East Coast, where it's only dulse now, or the Crispus crondus that's growing. So when I work with chefs, they sometimes get like, I only want this kind. And they're, well, no, we don't work that way. And you'll get the seaweeds that we all harvest. And that's gotten me into a little bit of trouble. But once they understand the rationale behind it, then they're full in there and just, and like that.
Right.
And that, so.
One of the other thoughts, just backtracking to what we were talking about earlier with the insects, and they attract insects, are seaweeds also of interest to any wildlife, or either in the ocean or from land?
Yep. Yeah, we seaweeds have their own types of insects. They have brown bugs on the brown seaweeds. They have green bugs on the green seaweeds. Mm. And you can see here the seaweeds behind us. They have flies and that and bugs on them now, but that's because it's spring and it's warm. But these are land terrestrial type insects on those ones. Mm-hmm. But in the ocean, they'll have their own bugs. The seaweeds like to be eaten by urchins. They're like little lawnmowers, you know, those beautiful purple things. And they cruise over the seaweed when they're starting to grow, and they can keep a bed down if there's lots of them. We had over harvesting here during the 80s, and we don't have a lot of sea urchins, and so we have a very big beds of kelp here. The other thing is that seaweeds are eaten by sea otters, not river otters, but sea otters. And of course, their populations were devastated, you know, a couple of hundred years ago. They're starting to come back and down the coastline. So they're out there. There has been evidence of the seaweeds out on the Oregon coast. They have a marine research area there. It's been there for about 25 years, 30 years, big stuff. And there's no hunting, no fishing, no spear, no diving, no nothing in that area. And they have videos of whales, gray whales, and I believe orcas. I'm not, but anyway, they have evidence of the grays going along, and they stash their young in the big giant bulk kelps. Mm. And then they go off, I guess, hunting, fishing, gathering food, and then they come back. And I kind of think of it like playpens, you know, the ultimate playpen. You can you stick them in there, and they can't get out. And they just hang there. Then the females go off, get their food, come back, and then they show them opening them up, and then the immatures, the youngsters, come out.
Diane Bernard of Outer Coast Seaweeds. As I wrapped up my visit with Diane along the shores of the Strait of Juan de Fuca, I asked her if she believes that wild seaweed harvesting for food use can become a more notable part of West Coast food culture.
Maybe as a last question, how much room do you think there is for more of, I guess, a seaweed culture here on the island as far as from a food perspective? Is there a lot of room for sustainable use of more seaweeds in our diet, at least here on Vancouver Island on the coast?
Seaweeds are fantastic as food. I think there's lots of opportunities here. What seaweeds have been used for in the past is sort of commodity-wise, and that is where they're stripped and used as thickeners and for products that don't allow separation. That, I think, is a crime, to take a fabulous resource like this and render it down to something that keeps our chocolate milk from separating. Mm. That is very offensive to me.
And that was Diane Bernard of Outer Coast Seaweeds, located in Sooke, British Columbia. I spoke to Diane in February 2010. More information on Diane's work is posted at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the February 25th, 2010 episode. You're tuned in to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated, listener-supported radio show and podcast produced in Nelson, British Columbia at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman. If you're a regular listener of the show, we'd certainly appreciate your financial support to keep this show on the air. Information on how to donate is posted on our website, deconstructingdinner.ca, and you can also call 250-352-9600 and inquire into how you can send a check or money order. In the second half of today's show, part 5 of our ongoing series, Deconstructing Dinner in Our Schools, a collection of episodes that examine how the subjects covered here on the show make their way into public schools, private schools, colleges, and universities. This part 5 is split into two segments, the second one, which will take us to Halifax, Nova Scotia, where university students there held an event to raise awareness of the food service contracts that their student union enters into, which in doing so restricts the types of food available to students. But first, we can remain in the community of Sooke on Vancouver Island, where not far from where I spoke with Diane Bernard is the local high school, serving the community and surrounding area. The Edward Milne Community School is also home to a unique and successful culinary arts program, the likes of which are rare to find in most Canadian high schools. Even better is that the program also interacts with their very own vegetable and herb garden and fruit trees growing right on the school property. Certainly, it's these types of programs and gardens geared towards young students that are absolutely critical to ensure a healthy level of gardening and food production knowledge within our communities. The Culinary Arts program will accommodate upwards to 55 students per day and is made up of students between grades 10 and 12. Leading the program are instructors Pia Carroll, who's been at the school for 14 years, and Marion French, who acts as the program's chef. I made a short visit to the school while in Souk to learn more about this great public school program.
My name is Pia Carroll. I'm a culinary arts teacher, chef, and I've been at the school for 14 years. And yes, it's just establishing, getting kids who are pretty green coming in, but if they've got enthusiasm and passion and they want to learn, then this is the place for them. And getting them ready for college to Camosun on the island here, or Malaspina, or some have springboarded off as far as Stratford. We had a student go there, and so wherever they want to go, we help them along their way. But they've got a lot of groundwork to do in the, you know, getting familiar with what they're making, the kinds of food they're making, and we infuse along the way. We've got really good culinary standards, and we help them by understanding where their food comes from. It's a slow process, but we get there eventually because we're very stubborn.
My name's Marion French, and I've been here for 2 years. I'm a chef, and I've been in this industry for 25 years. Before I was here, I worked at the Harbor House for 10 years. And so what I do here is I help the kids learn to cook.
After touring through the well-stocked kitchen used by students, Pia and Marion led me outside as we walked towards the program's very own garden and miniature fruit tree orchard. The garden is located on the other side of the high school's soccer field, and sure enough, as you'll hear in this next clip as Pia describes the culinary program in more detail, she gets dragged into the soccer game taking place on the field.
Well, as far as the framework of the school, when they come Friday, when they start out in grade 10, they learn all the basic sanitation and how a kitchen works, and they take food safe, and they've got to have that backbone to knowing what goes on. Hey, good stop there in the kitchen. And then they start the textbooks. We open up the textbooks, and there's a lot to learn, especially if they want to go on to Camosun, to the culinary college. The grade 12 year, we mesh it together so they can get dual credits towards college by being in our program for 3 blocks. And, you know, we give them lots of hands-on experience with cutting and the techniques. We do lots of different catering, which is fun. Yeah, like the we've got one coming up for CD Saturday soon in Souk, so they'll be part of that. It's the seed swap. It's the first one that's going to happen. And then there's a private catering coming up in March. We've got the Harbour House fundraising dinner in April. In May, we've got we support our athletic department, and they don't get a lot of money, as far as fundraising goes, so we ask for donations, and the kids make this sort of very basic dinner, but it's supporting the athletic banquet. And it's great because the money goes right to them when we're giving up our time and everything for that. And then we do there's another catering in we'll do a district dinner in a sit-down dinner. It's a buffet.
Yeah, in that's another 120 people.
Yeah, yes. In May. Then the culturally, we try and do field trips so the kids get to see other parts of the island. Like we go to Salt Spring, we visit the cheesemakers and the bread maker and people like that. We're going up to the Duncan area, and we'll go to Cowichan Bay Farm, True Grain Bakery, and Hillary's Cheese. So we're exposing them to how artisans are making a living with the really good food. Otherwise, they have no idea what's going on.
Mm-hmm. One thing, though, we probably didn't mention is that our philosophy is that we try to get the kids to really think about local foods, support local foods, think about where the food comes from, think about where the chicken lived, that sort of thing. It's important, and most kids especially don't think about that. They're, they just buy it at the store.
Marion French and Pia Carroll outlining the culinary arts program at Edward Milne Community School in Souk, British Columbia. As mentioned, the unique and successful high school program is also home to its very own vegetable and herb garden and small fruit orchard located directly on school property. While the garden is only used by the culinary students, other fields of study offered at the school have also lent their hand to the garden, such as that from the construction class who built the garden shed. So often here on the program, we discuss the ways in which food systems require so many other non-food related skills. And while this might seem obvious, it's a lesson rarely offered in public schools. This cross-collaboration among classes, such as the example here with the construction class lending their support, is a great example of the critical role in which school gardens and food programs can provide as far as offering this important lesson about the multifaceted social and economic benefits of local food production.
When Mara and Jasmine Phillip came along and said one summer 6 years ago, "We've got some money for you, and this is to build a garden here." It was like we were ecstatic because that's what we were working towards. So we found a corner just over here by the waterworks, it's called, and it's cordoned off. And we had to put the money into putting a fence, and we had a shed built by the construction class. But this is where it all started. So we have 22 fruit trees now, and we've got a bunch of, I know Marion's got more raspberry canes at home.
Mm-hmm. And we planted some last year.
We want to grow kiwi and a few more vines like that. And and we're going to have a greenhouse. So this corner is 15 by 25, the greenhouse will be. And we're in negotiations. We have been for quite a while with the district.
6 months.
Longer. About getting the greenhouse built. And right now, like Marion came out last Thursday, and you can see she went through the beds, and you know, we brought back a bucket of
eight students with me and
carrots.
And we weeded some beds, and we planted a few leeks, and we weeded the garlic. As you can see, there's lots of garlic there. Picked some kale. We're going to make kale chips in our dehydrator. So the kids are excited about that.
Yeah.
And so these students are coming in without any previous experience, maybe a little bit of experience?
From home, they have some experience. Yeah. But it was great. They were so into it. And we were eating kale, and we were picking some mustard greens. And I showed them the edible weeds. Of course, I learned all that from the Harbor House, all the different weeds that you can eat. So it was great.
What I see when students leave, the ones that have really... They've attached themselves. It's not something that they've learned from a book, but by feeling, touch, and taste, and they take that with them, and that is empowerment that you don't find from a book. You can take it in, but to actually work with the resources here, and then we can go cook with them as well. It's unbelievable what they take away.
Okay.
So you know that I don't stop to think about this until you ask, but. You know that there are kids out in the world that are going to make it different, and for the better, because they're understanding better where their food comes from and how it can be grown.
Also worth noting, as far as the school's garden, is the widespread community support that made the vision of that garden a reality back in 2004 when it was first constructed. Support came from organizations like Farm Folk City Folk, Life Cycles, Slow Food Vancouver Island, and the Souk Harbor House, among others. And in closing out my brief visit to the Edward Milne Community School, I asked Pia if similar high school culinary programs exist in the area. And she also shares some of the exciting upcoming plans for the culinary students, some of whom will be soon traveling to Stratford, Ontario, where another unique public school food and garden program is located.
We're lucky we've got another school in Esquimalt, another school in Victoria, one in Saanich, and one on Salt Spring Island, and all high schools, and they do these programs as well, and they're all really talented chefs that work in this field, because there is a bit of a difference in when you're a chef, you really know what it's like to be working in the kitchen, and you bring a lot of years experience with that. We're going on an exchange student trip to Stratford, Ontario this April. And so we go there with a group of 12 students, and then the students return and come here. So it's wonderful to be able to showcase the local food. We're going to have a seaweed demonstration and a lunch when the Stratford group come here. And we're also having a First Nations dinner. So that First Nations dinner is a collaboration between the Sauk Nation across the road from us, who will make the bannock and the barbecued salmon. and we bring all the vegetables and the dessert and things, and but it's an incredible feast to have together.
And that was Pia Carroll of the Culinary Arts Program at Edward Milne Community School in Sooke, British Columbia. We also heard from Marion French, the chef involved in the program. Deconstructing Dinner visited the school in February 2010. Taking us to the end of today's broadcast of Deconstructing Dinner in part 5 of our Deconstructing Dinner in Our Schools series, we travel to the other side of the country and onto the campus of Dalhousie University located in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Dalhousie's campus radio station, CKDU, is among the dozens of stations airing Deconstructing Dinner each week, and so we're happy to air some interviews recorded by CKDU's Asif Rashid in December 2009 at the student union building, The Sub, located on campus. Asif is one of many hosts of Operation Wake Up, and he interviewed students involved in the student-run group known as Campus Action on Food. On December 1st, the group held a free food event during which they distributed healthy and alternative options that are otherwise not offered in the student union building. The event was held to raise awareness of the confidential nature of the exclusivity contracts that the Dalhousie Student Union, the DSU, signs with food service giants Sodexo and PepsiCo. This is a common circumstance among many institutions like universities, and similar to the efforts at Dalhousie, many students are opposed to having only one food service distributor, or two, for that matter, providing them with their daily sustenance in a building such as that of the Student Union building. At the time of this December interview, 1,570 students had signed the petition calling on the Dalhousie Student Union to end such contracts with confidentiality clauses, so that students can thereby take part in a more transparent decision-making process as far as what foods might be available to them in the student union building. Here's CKDU's Asif Rashid.
So here's one of the folks who's around and helping get this thing set up. So tell me, what's going on here?
We're having a free food serving to make a statement in the sub on CAF, Campus Action on Food. So what we're protesting is the exclusivity contracts that are happening here at Dal and how they completely restrict the food that's offered in the sub and our options as students, and also exploit us as consumers.
What are you hoping is accomplished out of this event today?
We're hoping to raise awareness and just get people to realize that this isn't the way that things have to be, that there have been alternatives at other universities, and that universities are for the students, the student union building is for the students. We should have a say rather than be controlled by corporations.
All right, so talking to someone else who is at this food serving, enjoying the food?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all really great. Some actual healthy choices here in the sub as opposed to Tim Hortons or Pizza Pizza, something that probably we should have here on a regular basis.
What do you think of Sodexo?
What do I think of Sodexo? Well, I mean, the fact that they insist that all contracts signed must be under exclusivity rights is, that doesn't sit well at all. I mean, when nobody else can come into a building and have other options, you can't even give away free food in a building just because that's what they necessitate. It seems pretty domineering, to say the least. Big corporations, not that healthy food, have a huge monopoly over many, many institutions.
So what do you hope is achieved through this action today?
Our main goal is to raise awareness to this. We're giving away free food and that's awesome, but I mean, the goal is to raise awareness for people and to use that free food serving as a medium for getting that message across. I mean, you can definitely hold people's attention when you're giving away free food. Well, giving away free anything. You can hold people's attention for at least a little while. And just hopefully people are taking to heart, what we're doing, wanting healthy choices on campus for food available in any of the buildings, wanting to have the ability to be able to give away free food in any building if we want to do that, wanting to raise awareness about the secret contracts, especially with the motion going to vote tomorrow night, likely, unless it gets pushed back. People trying to encourage people to get in contact with their counselors and tell them that they want more transparency through the DSU. I mean, that's a part of it, too.
Also interviewed at the event organized by Campus Action on Food was a student who had recently come from another Canadian university, Trent, located in Peterborough, Ontario. Trent, like many universities, does in fact offer other options that are not restricted to just large multinational food service companies.
All right, so I got another person I'm talking to here at the food serving, And you used to go to another university, right?
I went for 2 years to Trent University in Peterborough.
What was the situation there with regards to exclusivity?
Well, there was a similar problem of exclusivity on campus in that the university had signed, I think it was a crazy amount of time. It was like a 90-year contract or something insane like that with Aramark rather than Sodexo. And they had another problem of exclusivity, much like they do here on campus. And so there was a lot of student action about that in the form of potlucks. And also I remember the Native Studies department used to have regular potlucks because they'd been told that they weren't allowed to, according to the terms of the contract.
Were there any gains made at Peterborough with regards to providing any student-run services for food?
Yeah, there was actually a OPERG working group that turned into a cooperatively run cafe called the Seasoned Spoon. And as far as I remember, they now are able to, but they're only allowed to have lunches or something like that, and technically it's all by donation, or they've found some like route around the exclusivity contract. But they, they're great. They do like local food, and they do catering, and they employ all students, and they pay really decent wages, and it's a fantastic alternative, and it'd be great if we could get, I think there's one in Montreal too, the People's Potatoes, so we could get more of those across Canada. That would be fantastic.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. CKDU's Asif Rashid continued his December 1st interview at Dalhousie University's Student Union building and inquired into the following day's council meeting of the Dalhousie Student Union.
We'd like to really focus in on the issue of that big vote tomorrow. So can you give us the context? What's going on tomorrow?
So tomorrow, the DSU Council is voting to send the decision to stop all secret contracts to be voted on at an AGM or by the membership. So right now, a lot of these food contracts are signed in secret and students can't find out about them. There was a SMAC campaign and petition and brought up in council. They're basically voting to let the membership vote on whether future contracts will be secret. We're doing an email campaign to try to push these counselors, put pressure on them. There's really no reason that they should vote for secrecy or that they should deprive the membership from voting on this. If counselors feel that it's an important issue, they feel that these contracts, like even if they haven't made up their mind, they should let the membership vote on it. These contracts are things that affect the membership directly, and the membership should vote on them.
So it's obvious what result you hope for tomorrow night. Do you have any predictions of how it might go?
I mean, a lot of counselors are on the edge, and it's a sad thing. I would say, you know, if they vote against it, it's a big opportunity to point out the lack of democracy, you know? if counselors vote against sending this to an AGM, if they vote for secrecy, they're voting against democracy, against transparency, and that's just a ridiculous thing. I have hope that with enough emails, like we're doing a big email campaign to let counselors know that this is something students care about, with enough emails that counselors will come around, but, you know, we'll wait and see.
The following day, the issue was indeed brought into the council meeting of the Dalhousie Student Union, and the council voted to send the petition of 1,570 names to their Board of Operations to study the feasibility of discontinuing contracts with confidentiality clauses. Over the course of the following 2 months, a number of delays pushed the board's decision to February, when they issued a report that advised against the motion, thereby maintaining the status quo that food service contracts within the student union building will continue to remain confidential. According to the report, food service suppliers who they consulted with were fearful that competitors would have access to their, quote, trade secrets, and are therefore not in their best interest. More information and updates on the issue can be found at studentsmobilize.com and are also linked to on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the February 25th, 2010 broadcast, where today's show is also archived.
Don't make me eat that cafeteria food. My stomach's feeling queasy, it's not in the mood for cardboard pizza with tomato on top. If I see another fish stick, I'm gonna drop. I said, please, please, please don't make me eat that cafeteria food. Please, please, please don't make me eat that cafeteria food. The stuff they serve and they call macaroni and cheese. Every time I see it, it makes me want to sneeze. I think that's a sausage, but it's only a hunch. If I find out it's a hot dog, I'm gonna lose my lunch. I said, please, please, please don't make me eat that cafeteria food. Please, please, please don't make me eat that cafeteria food.
Monday.
Meatballs made of sawdust and paste.
Tuesday.
Turkey that died of old age.
Wednesday.
Spaghetti.
Thursday.
Swiss steak.
Friday.
I don't know, but it's crawling off the plate. Please, please, please don't make me eat that cafeteria food. Please, please, please don't make me eat that cafeteria food. I've eaten hamburger till I'm starting to moo, and toasted cheese that tasted like a rubber balloon. Today we're having chili, or is it beef stew? Well, I can't tell the difference, and neither can you. Oh, please, please, please don't make me eat that cafeteria food. Please, please, please don't make me eat that cafeteria food. No, please, please, please don't make me eat that cafeteria food. Please, please, please don't make me eat that cafeteria food.
I dreamt that all cafeteria food was made by a man who was all tattooed from the top of his head to the tip of his toes. Did I mention he had a big bone in his nose? He started with a sticky paste that vaguely resembled industrial waste. He mixed it in a humongous vat with lots of sugar and lots of fat. He put it through a big machine that turned it all fluorescent green. He spread it on a cookie sheet that measured 100 by 100 feet. I knew this cook was really brave, 'cause he used a nuclear microwave that looked just like a laser gun. In 17 seconds it was done. He chopped it into rectangular blocks, packed it away, 10 to a box, then put it in a big deep freeze, minus 240 degrees. They shipped it to our school and then started the process all over again. The stuff at our school started to thaw, but they still had to cut it with a saw. They plopped it on cafeteria trays. We ate the same stuff for 62 days, till everyone in school turned green, and everyone in school turned mean. The teachers and kids and principal too were all overcome by this terrible goo. This stuff made sure it was all we could munch, 'cause it made us forget to pack our lunch. We started to rave, we started to hop, and all education came to a stop. About this time I became aware I was having a terrible nightmare. I opened my eyes, I jumped out of bed, I ran to the place where my daddy read the newspaper in the morning each day to see what the school lunch menu would say. Imagine my relief when I saw it was choice of lasagna or cheese pizza. I started to shout, I started to leap. My dad told me to go back to sleep. I did not mind, go back to my room, 'cause I knew I was safe from that terrible doom. But to whatever it is makes you dream when you sleep, I'd say no more nightmares like that, please. They make my skin creep.
And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. Those last two songs heard on the show today were in order. We played them by New Hampshire's Ken Sheldon, and the second by Virginia's Bill Wellington. This radio show is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.